Thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks very much for the opportunity to speak here. I'm very excited. Like I said, I came all the way from Waterloo, so it's been a long journey. No, that's not good. I'm not sure what's up with that. Anyway, so I want to tell you guys today about trisections of four manifolds, which is sort of a very recent tool in understanding four manifold topology, which hopefully it stays up. I think it's sort of still in its infancy, and there's still a lot of things that can be done, and hopefully there's some interaction here or just something new that happens. So my plan today is to give sort of an expository talk, something which is accessible, with lots of pictures and not too many four manifold topology technicalities. Hopefully not get bogged down too much. It's a four manifold idea that takes very direct inspiration from something in three-manifold topology called the Haggard splitting. So I'd like to spend probably the first 20, 30 minutes talking about Haggard splittings, and then sort of in parallel do what goes on for four-manifolds. So of course, if there's any questions, please just stop me and harass me about them. If there are more technical questions, I'd love to discuss afterwards as well. Okay, so maybe let's get started. So I should have one slide about motivation. And then I will dispense with that entirely. So I have no real physics training. I'm supposed to be a four-manifold topologist. So my interest in this stuff is purely four-manifold.
It's not much.
Oh, is it doing something funny? I don't know. We'll see. It's about as tight as it gets, so we'll see. Okay, well, I can just keep going. We'll see what happens. I just don't move it, maybe it'll be okay. So here's something sort of to motivate some of this. This doesn't have a whole lot to do with trisections, but here's sort of a very landmark result in four-manifold topology from the 80s. And so four-manifold topology is sort of the first place where you start to witness exotic smooth structures. Dimensions 3 or lower, you have unique smooth structures for all manifolds, but dimension 4 is stuff, weird things start to happen. If you restrict your attention to, let's say, smooth 4 manifolds, and also simply connected, because of course if you don't, the problem is just too hard, then you, as a result of a couple different theorems, you can obtain the following, which is that the homeomorphism type of smooth, simply connected four manifolds is governed by their intersection forms. So intersection forms, of course, is the intersection form is the bilinear pairing that you get on second cohomology by wedging together two elements and evaluating against the fundamental class. And this again has nothing really to do with trisections, but The point is that smooth structure and homeomorphism type don't really agree, and a lot of weird things happen. So it's a very sort of rich, exciting place to do math. Trisections is hopefully a way to understand this maybe a little better. We'll see. Anyhow, like I said, I'm going to instead not talk about trisections for 20 minutes and tell you about a very important tool out of three-manifold topology. So this is something called a Haggard splitting. Of a three-manifold, Haggard should have two A's as a type of. So I will maybe begin with the following not so rhetorical question. What's sort of an easy way to build a closed three-manifold? I should say all the manifolds in this talk are nice. They're smooth, they're orientable, they're connected, they're compact, they have no boundary, blah, blah, blah. What's an easy way to build a closed three-manifold? So I'll take away all the examples, not S3 and not products. One easy way to make a closed three-manifold is just to take product of other closed manifolds, S1 cross S1 cross S1. Apart from that, what else could a person do? It's sort of a weird thing to think about if you haven't before. So I'll give you sort of a recipe. Here's what you could do. You could start with two solid handle bodies. All right, handle body, I mean the By handle body, I mean the three-dimensional manifold which bounds a surface, it's solid. Two of those, or the same one twice, however you want to think of it. Just for clarity, I've written that as, on the right, it's a boundary-connected sum of S1 cross B2. S1 cross B2 is the solid torus. The boundary-connected sum is the operation which induces on boundary the connected sum. That is to say, this is true. So you can glue two four manifolds together, or glue two manifolds with boundary together along their boundary in such a way that the boundaries inherit an actual honest connected sum. That bothers you. Anyways, take two of these and pick any homeomorphism you like from the boundary of the boundary of the Hannell body to itself. Any homeomorphism you like. And now just glue those two Hannell bodies together along that map. You can just do this, right? It's a homeomorphism. In fact, that's closed, right? Because you just killed off all the boundary. It's gone. Points in the boundary got identified with something else in a boundary, and now it's just a closed-through manifold. But like, what do you get when you do this? You could get a whole bunch of things, right? If I glue along the identity map on the boundary, then, I mean, I'll get the identity map on the boundary will leave the S1 alone and we'll glue the two disks together and you'll get a connected sum of S1 cross S2s. But, I mean, I'm allowed to this is just the genus of the Hannell body, the genus of the surface that it bounds.
No, it's not something you attach to S1.
Sorry, say it again?
So, what is it, this number G, S1?
Oh, it's just so like a connected sum. Like a, you know, like G fold copies of a connected sum. Yeah, so G times. Yeah, sorry, so that was clear. If you do the identity, you'll get that manifold, but you know, in principle, there are many more. Right? I sort of said you could use anything you like. And so let's just, for the moment, maybe just formalize this. You start with a nice three-manifold. A Hegard splitting of that manifold is a decomposition into two equal pieces. Okay, into the union of two Hannell bodies. So schematically, it should look something like this. I've drawn here M is a three-manifold. Sitting inside of it, there's some central surface, and to each side it bounds a Hannell body, and they together fill out the whole three-manifold. We have to use Hannell bodies a bunch. I'll denote them H sub G for genus, and if there's more than one, I'll put the index in the top. So that's a Hegard splitting. I mean, it's just a definition that a person can make. Sort of a surprising fact is that actually any three-manifold admits such a decomposition. Okay, you can always do this. Now, I don't know what the genus might be, but you can always do this. Okay. So maybe I'll give a very short proof. So the first thing you might want to do is just say, okay, assume that you have a triangulation of your manifold. If it's smooth, of course, there's no problem. If you've started with something which is maybe a priori not smooth, you might worry. In three-manifold topology, this turns out not to be a problem because of some very hard theorems. Moise and Bing in the 50s show that you can always do this. And sort of looking forward to four-manifolds, this you might worry about this a lot, actually, because there are four-manifolds which are just not triangulable. But, I mean, it's a three-manifold, so we can do this. So what is a triangulation? Triangulation, start with a bunch of vertices, connect those vertices with edges, fill in the regions with triangular two-dimensional faces, fill in the remaining regions with sort of like solid tetrahedron. And you're supposed to, you know, glue a bunch of these together in some way and to fill out a closed three-manifold. Right? So here I've drawn sort of standing in the way. Here I've drawn maybe one such tetrahedron living inside of my three manifolds. So I'm going to show you how do you see a Hegart splitting. So take this triangulation, look at the one skeleton. The one skeleton is the vertices union all of its edges. So it looks like something you would make out of sort of, I don't know, marshmallows and toothpicks or something like this. And just thicken that up. So take a regular neighborhood of that living inside of the three manifold. So now that looks something like this. It's some sort of thickened object. And that's a handle body. Because it is. And I claim in fact that the complement is also a handle body. And this is sort of not something that is generally true. If you just take a handle body, look at its complement, why should it be a handle body? Even so, you all might even worry about whether or not it's connected, things like this. But in this case it's true. The reason being that it's actually a regular inhabitant of another one skeleton. The one skeleton is the dual triangulation, or the dual skeleton, to the one that we just drew. And this is what you get if you start with, in every tetrahedron, you put a vertex in the center, and you connect all of those vertices in your three manifold through the faces. So I'll draw sort of, this is one vertex in the center of that tetrahedron, and then I'm gonna put vertices that run out of the faces. So it's like you take the solid tetrahedron and you skewer it with a bunch of toothpicks to intersect the vertexes in the center. And so the complement of the first handle body is actually just a regular neighborhood of that second skeleton. Okay. And together they fill out the three manifold. They have some common boundary, which is a surface. And there you go. There's a Hegart splitting of your three manifold. Okay. Now, again, I sort of have absolutely no control over the genus of the thing that I just built. And I took a triangulation. The triangulation could have, you know, a million vertices. It can be a huge Hegart splitting. But at least you can always do this. Okay, so maybe quickly, I think I owe you some examples. So what's the simplest possible Hegart splitting? The genus zero Hegart splitting of S3. This is what you get when you take S3 and you cut it into two 3 balls. You take a sphere and you cut it along its equator. You get two balls of the same dimension, and you can glue them along their common boundary and you'll get S3. If this sort of bothers you, this is the same, it's the same statement that this is true. You take S2. Take a regular sphere, and you can cut it along its equator to get two disks glued along in S1. So the same thing is true. This is genus zero because these sort of quote unquote handle bodies have no genus. Okay. Is there any questions about that? Or anything that I can clarify? Maybe about the definition about Hegart splitting? Okay, so far. Okay. Okay, so here's maybe the next simplest example. I'll stick over here.
I think for people working with quantum gravity, this free quantum gravity uses a lot of that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so here's the next simplest example. So I'm going to show you very briefly a genus 1 Hegart splitting of S3. Okay. So what do I need to do? I need to write S3 as a union of two solid tori. Right? They should intersect along an actual tori. I should just be able to draw this picture. Okay. I can't draw S3 on the board, but I can draw R3. So I'll draw R3. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you, so it's a union of two solid tori. I'm going to show you the core circles for those two tori. I draw those in yellow. And then somehow this is going to fill out all of R3. So here's the first one. It's just a circle in the XY plane, I guess. And here's the second one. Okay. So I've just drawn the z-axis. Of course, this is actually a circle, because when I one-point compactify R3, get a, like an actual circle. And so you get, you know, two core circles that intersect, they look like a Hopf link. Okay. And now, where are the tori? The tori are supposed to be neighborhoods of these core circles. Okay, so one of them is just looks like this. The other one just looks like this. So this is sort of not a great picture. It's the best I can do. But you can draw something a little better, and it looks like this. Okay? So there's R3, or sort of S3, written as a union of two solid tori. Sort of a nice visualization exercise to like convince yourself this is actually what's going on. Sorry, say it again?
The two handle bodies, are they always equal for any three manifolds?
That's right, yeah. So they necessarily have to have the same genus because they bound the same surface. And then there's some classification result that says that, yeah, they actually have to be diffeomorphic. Okay. Here's something that you can do, given a Hegart splitting. If you have a Hegart splitting of a given genus, you can always fairly easily increase it by one. This is called stabilization. And I will give you a very quick picture definition of what this is. So I'm imagining I start with a Hegart splitting of a given genus, and I zoom in very close somewhere, so there's no genus, it just looks flat. So here's the central surface, cutting apart my three-manifold, at least locally, into two sort of three-dimensional regions. So it just looks like a plane. On either side, you have something three-dimensional. What you can do is you can take this and replace it with the following decomposition of one higher genus. All I've done is I've taken that what looked like a flat plane before, and I just attached a small tube to it. Right, so this is now the boundary. This is part of the surface, and obviously underneath this decomposition has been rearranged so that, you know, what's underneath actually now also runs through this tube. It's been taken right from the top. So that's the decomposition. It just has one higher genus. You might worry about this being well defined, as you should. Sort of like I just sort of just drew a picture and said this was fine. Most of the time, you only really consider Hegart splittings up to isotopy of the whole manifold, amidisotopy, whatever you really mean by that. One parameter perturbations of your manifold, which carry, you know, the central surface around. And if that's all you really care about, then this is fine, right? If I perturb this a little bit, if I just move this handle a little bit over here, then it's obviously still the same splitting. Essentially. So up to isotopy, this is okay. So one thing you might do if you only care about Hegart splittings up to isotopy, is you might draw some sort of graph. And I mean, if I only consider isotopic classes of splittings, this is some discrete set. It would look something like this. Maybe there's none in genus 0, maybe there's some in genus 1. Some genus 2. So I just told you can always go up in dimension. Up in genus, rather. So you can always, from every class in this graph, you can always go one up, right? So I can, maybe it looks something like this. Go up, these go up, these go up, these go up somewhere. So you have some graph like this. It's not sort of obvious that there should be finitely many such classes. It's often true, but not always. Um, But in fact, there's sort of a very strong, important structural result, which sort of governs the behavior of these sorts of graphs. This is sort of a common theme. This sort of theorem will come up over and over and over again. It will come up for the trisections. It's the analogs of what's called the Rittmeister-Singer theorem. So that's one that I put in the top. Any two Hagard splittings of a given three-manifold are what's called stably isotopic. So up to stabilization, they become isotopic. So essentially, if I pick any two nodes on this graph, I can stabilize them a bunch until they have some common refinement, some common stabilization, like some common element. In other words, that graph is a tree, right, facing downwards. Again, very, very sort of common style of theorem. There are sort of maybe a couple other kind of Cole's notes theorems that a person should know when it comes to Hagard splittings. The first is Hawkins' lemma. This one thing you might do if you have two three-manifolds which admit Hagard splittings of a given genus, you could connect some of them together. In fact, you could do so in such a way that you really want the splittings to actually you really want to do the splitting in such a way that you perform it along the central surface, or the connected sum along the central surface. So if I have two three manifolds, I want to actually induce a Hagard splitting on the connected sum. You can do this. This is fine. Hawkins' lemma tells you the converse. So it tells you that if you have a manifold which you know a priori splits as a connected sum, then any Hagard splitting for that connected sum will decompose as the connected sum of two Hagard splittings for each of the pieces. So as far as studying these sorts of stuff goes, it really suffices to study irreducible theorems. You really don't need, maybe it's interesting for other reasons, but Hagard splittings decompose over connected sum. Okay, very, very powerful result. The last sort of important instructional result governs what the Hagard splittings of S3 look like. Known as Waldhausen's theorem. And it says that every Hagard splitting of S3 is a stabilization of the trivial one. I gave you two, gave you genus 0 and a genus 1. In fact, that's really all there is up to this stabilization. The genus 1 splitting that I gave you is a stabilization of the genus 0, 1, and all the way up. That's it. This graph is a tree, but it's also just a straight line. Okay. Very, very sort of strong theorem. When we go on to talk about trisections, we'll see that the first one has an analog. There's a direct analog, quite recent. The other two, we don't know. No idea what would be true there. If they happen to be true, if one or the other happens to be true, you obtain very, very strong results. You sort of accidentally prove the smooth four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture, for instance. So that would be cool.
Which conjecture?
Like smooth four-dimensional. But there's no exotic S4. So are there any questions about the statements of those theorems? Anything I can clarify? Okay.
Second theorem, I suppose when you say it decomposes, it's compatible with the connected sum.
That's right. Yeah, so there's a way of if you have two manifolds with Hagard splittings, you can patch them together to get a Hagard splitting of the connected sum. And this says that any time you have a Hagard splitting of a manifold with splits, you can split that Hagard splitting. Go backwards, essentially. Okay. So there's one more thing that I think we'll talk about is the notion of a Hagard diagram. So if you have a three-manifold and Hagard splittings, there's a way to sort of diagrammatically encode what's going on with that splitting. I'm not going to get too much into the weeds of how these diagrams produce three-manifolds. I'll wave my hands a little bit and say that it's okay, but I'd love to talk about it afterwards as well. So what is a diagram? Diagram consists of a surface with two sets of curves. There's an alpha set, there's a beta set, usually red and blue. And they together somehow are going to describe the particular Hegard splitting of your three manifold that you have in mind. On the left, there's a Hegard splitting of S3. And on the right, there's a Hegard splitting of actually that's S1 cross S2. Maybe I'll say just sort of a couple words about what these curves are doing. Okay. If you have your three manifold and you see this central surface, what you really need is you need to understand, I mean, as I go sort of up and down, whatever that's supposed to mean, I need to describe a cobordism from, let's say, a neighborhood, the boundary of a neighborhood sigma cross I to the empty set. So I need to know how to build a cobordism. What those circles are telling you is, how do you attach three-dimensional two handles in order to kill off all of this genus as you go up? Essentially, so I mean, if you look at all of the level sets as you go up, maybe you might, you know, the central surface has genus 2, and then maybe up here it has genus 1. And then over here is just a ball. And you need to know how to get from here to here. What these curves are telling you is, okay, I'm going to draw a curve here. I'm going to produce a cobordism which kills off this genus. Again, I don't want to get too deeply into that. The other really nice thing about these diagrams is that as far as connected sum goes, all you really have to do is connect some of the diagrams together. So if you want a manifold, if you want a Hegard diagram, or a connected sum manifolds, all you do is paste their diagrams together. It doesn't really matter how you do this. In particular, if you look on the right, I told you already that this is a Hegard diagram for S3. This looks like a Hegard diagram for something connected sum S3. Right? It's the same piece. And I mean, you connect sum S3 to something. Get the same manifold back. And so really, stabilization, this is actually the stabilization operation that we described here on the level of diagrams. You want to stabilize your three manifold, all you do is tack on the diagram for the genus 1 splitting of S3, and you'll produce something better. So maybe here's sort of the list of facts that a person should know about these sorts of diagrams. Such a diagram encodes a particular Hegard splitting. Particular, it encodes a three-manifold. There's a set of moves on diagrams, which if you do any of these moves, you still produce isotopic Hegard splittings. And so the moves are something called a handle slide, which I won't get too much into because it's sort of hard to explain, but it's very easy to do on a diagram. Isotopy of the curves on the surface. So if you wiggle these curves around on the diagram, it shouldn't really matter. In fact, that's true. And just straight up diffeomorphisms of the surface carrying curves to curves. So if you go through any one of those three moves, you won't change the particular Hegard splitting that you had in mind. And then sort of as a corollary to the Rademacher-Singer theorem, if you have you just have two Hegard diagrams and you want to know, are they the same three-manifold? Never mind the splitting that you have in mind, are they the same three-manifold? Then they need to be related by the same moves plus stabilizations. Okay, so that was a statement of the Rademacher-Singer theorem, says that I can stabilize them both till they become isotopic. Okay, so on the level of diagrams, what it means is you should be able to stabilize the diagrams a bunch of times and then do a sequence of these moves. Okay, so it's a diagrammatic calculus to understand three manifolds. Any sort of questions that I can answer about these Hegard diagrams before I move on? Okay, so far so good.
Is it always a single connected manifold?
Yeah. Everything for this stuff is always connected.
So in your diagram, it's only one spot.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So want to talk now about trisections. So this is sort of the motivating question really is what's the four-dimensional analog of a Hagard's book?
What's happened to the old story of classification of three manifolds? I mean, does this bear on it?
I think it's. I don't know if it. I actually don't know the three manifold story super, like the geometrization story super well. I don't know that it has. I don't know that it bears a whole lot in that story. Not that I'm aware of. Could be wrong. Okay, so what is the four-dimensional analog? I mean, I don't want to do it. Someone wants to produce a sort of analogous theory for four manifolds. Four manifolds are hard. Smoothly, they're hard. What can you do? The first thing you might do is just cut your four manifold in half and do the exact same thing. This time I want to use four-dimensional one-handle bodies. Okay, so what's a four-dimensional one-handle body? We used HG already. I'm going to use ZG to denote such things. And this is the boundary connected sum of S1 cross B3s. So to compare with HG is the boundary connected sum of S1 cross B2. Okay. So you might ask, okay, can I actually just perform the same story? Can I just cut them in half? Worth noting, the boundary of this thing is actually connected sum of S1 cross S2s. Again, it induces, when I take the boundary, it induces a connected sum on the boundary. But this sort of a very, very strong, very, I almost want to say the word magical theorem, by Laudenbach-Pointeroux from, I think, the 70s, which has other important consequences. But what it says is that any diffeomorphism of this boundary will extend across the interior. Equivalently, maybe an easier way of phrasing that is that if you intend to glue a four-dimensional one-handle body to something, there's only one way to do this. So if you see a hole which, you know, has the correct boundary and you want to glue a one-handle body to it, you can only do this in one way, up to isotopy of the map and hence diffeomorphism of the result. This is also, if people are familiar with the language, this is also the statement that the three and four handles of a four-manifold attach uniquely. So I won't say anything more. The three and four handles of a four-manifold always attach uniquely, if people are familiar with that language. If not, that's all right. In other words, the point is any two ways of gluing a handle body to a manifold are essentially equivalent. What this means for us and cutting four manifolds into two pieces is if I want to cut a four manifold into two pieces, say I want to do the same thing. I want to glue ZG to ZG along some map F. Then it doesn't matter what map I use, and I may as well use the identity map. Okay, and essentially the same calculation that we wrote down at the beginning tells you that you wind up with a connected sum of S1 cross S3s. And that's just not all four manifolds. So you can cut four manifolds into two pieces, but they have to be S1 cross S3s. So you're sort of out of luck there. But you can do something else. And something else is a trisection.
What about the other ones, like S2 plus?
Oh, I mean, you... The point is here that if you could cut a closed four manifold into two equal pieces, which are handle bodies, then it had to have been a connected sum of S1 cross S3s. That's sort of
the definition of handle body that it has
to. Oh yeah, this
it can't be S2 cross B2 or something.
Yeah, that's right. This is when I say like four dimensional one handle body. That's the object that I mean. Yeah, you might be able to cut different things, but that's sort of the simplest building block in many ways.
I thought when you sort of used Morse theory, you got other...
Yeah. These are the handles. Yeah. I guess as far as using one-handle bodies. Yeah. So I'll put the definition of a trisection up. It's sort of a lot at first, but I'll draw a schematic which sort of makes it maybe a little more clear. So this is the, instead of cutting into two pieces, cut it into three. And I'll draw a schematic. The point is going to be, it's going to be three four-dimensional one-handle bodies, and it's going to have very particular intersection data. So again, everything is nice. X is a four-manifold, it's closed, smooth, orientable, everything. I want to do the following thing. I should be very careful about language I use. This notion and proofs and everything is due to David Gay and Robert Kirby from as far back as 2012. Okay. So here's your four-manifold X. I want to cut it into three pieces. X1, X2, and X3, each of which are four-dimensional one-handle bodies of genus K. Okay, so they're a K-connect boundary sum of S1 cross B3s. The intersection pattern pairwise, so if I take X1 intersect X2, X2 intersect X3, X1, blah, 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 I wind up with the three-dimensional handle body that we were talking about earlier. Okay, better written down. Yeah, okay. And so, I mean, worth noting, again, boundary of each XI is is a connected sum of S1 cross S2s. This is saying that each of these pieces should be a genus G, three-dimensional one-handle body. And the last thing that I'm sort of going to insist on is that the triple intersection, it's a bit low actually, should be a surface of genus G. Okay? So it's a very particular intersection pattern. I don't want just three one-handle bodies that union together to give a four-manifold. I want them to decompose the four-manifold in that particular way. Okay. Any questions about that definition? It's a bit sort of strange to take in at first. I'm gonna do a couple examples in a second. Yeah.
You might have said this before, but are you limiting to orientable now?
Yeah. I think there is an extension of this that may work in the non-orient. It's just messier. You can also do this if it has boundary, and it's, again, messier. But the same idea. Okay. So here's sort of the structural result as promised. It's the analog of the Rademacher-Singer theorem, but for trisections. So again, David Gay and Robert Kirby, I think as far back as 2012, 2013, published in 2016. Every nice closed four manifold admits a trisection. You can always decompose your manifolds like this, and you have this sort of stably isotopic result. And any two trisections are always isotopic after you're allowed to stabilize them. I won't say a whole lot about what the stabilization operation is here, but it's basically the same thing. Before I wanted to increase the genus of each of the handle bodies. By doing so, I increase the genus of the central surface as well. In this case, it sort of seems a little odd that it should increase the two parameters slightly differently. But basically, I want to increase the genus of each piece by one. And because they triply intersect in something, it ends up increasing the genus of the central surface by three. Doesn't really matter. It's also sometimes convenient to, I didn't define it, but it's also convenient to work with unbalanced trisections. Sometimes I might want to allow the handle bodies to have different genus. So like this might not all be K. I might have, you know, like 1, 2, and 3, something like this. And you can stabilize in an unbalanced way as well, but it's just, again, sort of messier to deal with. But again, structurally the same result is true. The analog of the Rademacher theorem, Rademacher-Singer theorem is it holds. Okay, I'm going to say a couple words about proofs. So we gave a proof infer the existence of Heygaard splittings of three manifolds using triangulations. That's one way to do it. There's another way to prove that you always have a Heygaard splitting, and that's with Morse functions. So I'll say a couple words about this. Basically, the idea is if you start with a three manifold, pick any sort of suitably generic smooth function you like to the real line. Okay? M is compact, so its image is an interval. And that smooth map, if it's sort of generically enough, if it's generic enough, has finitely many critical points. And those critical points have indices. It's basically the number of downward directions, which you can compute as the signature of the Hessian at each of these points. Morse, sort of general Morse theory, lets you, up to homotopy of the function, rearrange those points. And what you basically wind up doing is you say, okay, start with any smooth function you like and improve it until you produce a Heygaard splitting. Yeah, but the details sort of don't matter too much. You start with M, you map it to an interval. And just sort of improve the function in some way or another so that I can take a value in the middle somewhere that pulls back to a surface and the opposite pieces pull back to handlebodies. It's not always true for random smooth maps, but if I improve the function a bunch, I can arrange that it's true. The proof strategy for four manifolds that I'm aware of is not with triangulations. Triangulating your four manifold does you no good in many ways because in the three-manifold case, it just so happened that the second handlebody was a complement of a one skeleton. In the four dimensions, it just doesn't work out this way. The strategy instead is, okay, start with a generic smooth function from X to a disk. Okay. And then again, improve this function until you can trisect the disk, pull back the pieces to get an actual trisection. Now, of course, in this case, this ends up being a lot harder because the set of critical points is now, it's not a bunch of points, it's some one-dimensional submanifold. And its image is some number of closed curves in a disk. And those closed curves can intersect, they're immersed, they can intersect themselves, they can intersect each other. They can have cusp points. All kinds of terrible things happen, and so you have to prove a whole bunch of really, really technical things about being able to rearrange such maps. But you can do it, and then you pull back each of the pieces, and you wind up with the decomposition. So it's much messier, and it really relies on a lot of sort of heavy-duty Morse theory. And that's sort of all I wanted to say about that. Any questions about the philosophy behind that? Maybe not the details, but the philosophy.
More about this Morse theory when you don't have an order there.
Sorry, can you say that again?
I mean, usually, an interval, you have an order.
So I see.
So here, can you just say a bit more?
Yeah, so in this case, so in this case, the idea is that, so it's not really a Morse function anymore, because it's a disk. It's like a Morse, people call them Morse two functions. So they're generic maps to disks, generic maps to surfaces even. And what they look like, they generically look like homotopies of Morse functions. That's the sort of like, Morse functions have, at any given point, they have some sort of standard model. The standard model for Morse 2 functions is now what the standard models for homotopies of Morse functions would look like. So you have, it looks like taking a surface cross disk, projecting it to a disk. And so you wind up with one-dimensional critical sets. Imagine taking a sphere and projecting it to it, like a sphere cross disk projected to a disk.
Can you, maybe
yeah,
so
you,
like in the Morse function, the torus and the line.
Yeah. So like what you,
typical example of how you think of
if this is your disk, the images of the critical sets now look like things like this. They're a bunch of closed curves, and they do sort of very weird things. They may have
so
custom.
That's
the image of the critical set in B2. Yeah, and so now you have to, say things about, okay, I want to rearrange all of these critical sets in such a way that.
Yes, the critical sets are curves.
That's right.
And you find the critical sets in this.
Same way.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so just start, yeah, start with a smooth map to a disk. What are the, yeah.
And usually, yeah. Most of there's a theorem that, you know, it's always a quadratic function or a point.
Yeah.
So what's the analysis there?
There are standard models, but they're sort of messier. There's a list of sort of standard models. Like they, in the Morse function, you know, okay, every point is sort of a saddle point,
yeah.
or it's standard.
Yeah,
so here it's like, it's either just like saddle point cross time, or it's like a cusp point. What you would sort of see if you homotope a Morse function and cancel two critical points. It's sort of hard to draw. Maybe I can talk about it later if you like, if you don't mind.
Some obvious reason why there's one dimensional.
I think that's.
Why are they one dimensional instead of?
Basically, I mean, imagine if you have a surface cross disk. And you project to a disk, you essentially wind up with like a one-dimensional set of critical values. I don't know. I'm not sure how to. It's sort of you sort of run down a rabbit hole once you start talking about Morse two functions.
Is it maybe obvious why they close?
I mean, what would the end? Like everything is closed. Like the four manifold that you start with is closed. I think that's the reason.
So the sense is pretty good.
Yeah, you can't just have it stop. And again, you start with something suitably generic, so this you sort of avoid. Yeah. Anyways, sort of much messier, but still sort of doable. Okay, so I'll give sort of two very brief examples. So the first example is again the sort of genus zero trisection of S4. There was a genus zero trisection of S or Hegart splitting of S3 that we wrote down. This is essentially the same idea. In the three-dimensional case, we had a picture which basically looked like this. We took two 3-balls. We glue them together along their boundary, which is S2, and I produced S3. Cut a sphere in half along its equator. The trisection of S4 is sort of schematically the following. I'll show you how to produce S4. I'm actually going to use 3 colors. So these are all B4s. And I'm going to glue them together schematically like this. I'm going to glue two hemispheres together, glue two hemispheres together, and then the other two hemispheres together. This is essentially it's the picture if you take an orange, like the S2 boundary of an orange, and you cut it into three pieces. You have three pieces. This is S2 now. You have three pieces. They're glued together along a B1. Their triple intersection is the two top and bottom points, which is an S0. It's sort of, again, just like the Hegart splitting, you can always sort of cut a sphere into two equal pieces. You can always cut a sphere into three equal pieces.
So what's the corresponding Morse two function in that case?
Sorry, say that again?
What is the corresponding Morse two function?
It's what you get by mapping S4 to a disk in like the just put first two coordinates, first two coordinates, and then pull back the pieces.
So you project along which direction?
Along the axis. Yeah. Like imagine like standing and straight down. Yeah, because in this sort of case, this is S2. You imagine mapping to a disk which is here, and then pulling back, lifting. The next example is very similar.
So what's it? I think I missed. When you were doing the three manifold,
yeah.
Like you had some Hegart splitting of just one component. Maybe I didn't understand. It looked like you were gluing saddle points to itself.
That's right.
And getting a. So does it have to be three, or can it be somehow So, I mean, in that case, it didn't have to always be two pieces.
It was two.
Yeah. It was always two.
Even when you're with a solid torus to itself, you mean another fabric.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, the Hilbert splitting is always two pieces. It's always two pieces. This, it's three, but they have very precise sort of intersection data.
At one point, you showed just one solid torus. It looked like just one, and you said, this is a Hilbert splitting.
I see. Yeah, so I mean, as you sort of sweep out through tori, you'll see a whole family of them. But you can just cut it into two. That's sort of the, I think that's the, maybe, I don't
you know. What
yeah,
I'm,
okay. I'm not sure, okay.
If you go back a few.
Sure.
But you meant maybe it's a Higa tori, or?
Maybe,
okay.
If you just go back, I'll tell you, maybe I just missed it.
Sure.
That one, oh, no.
This one here?
On the left.
On the left?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
that's one.
So that's the diagram for S3. It's not actually the.
The other torus is the outside of the torus.
Yeah.
All the other torus is
the
complement of.
That's right. Yeah.
Nice.
It gets.
And the lines are roughly telling you which cycles are.
That's right. As you go out in each direction, up or down, in this case, you need to kill off. Okay. The sort of other example, which I won't say very much about, it's just sort of a. Point of interest. For CB2, there's a moment map to CB. There's a moment map to a. There's a moment map to a disk. Essentially, polytope. It's like a triangle, and this map sort of has the property. I won't define the moment map. This map has the property that. Pre-images of interior points are tori. Pre-images of things along the edges are circles, and pre-images of these vertices are points. And what you can do, I won't say very much about this, but what you can do is just take this picture, trisect it. Oops, that's not good. No more green. Trisect that polytope, pull back the pieces. And a person has to check this, their details, but this point pulls back to a torus, which is the sort of the central surface which is supposed to live in that copy of CP2. And one can check, it's not totally easy, but one can check that the pre-images of these regions are actually four balls. So what you've done is you've exhibited CP2 as the union of three four balls glued together essentially along a torus. That's sort of the other sort of nice example. But you have to sort of fiddle with it to see it. It's sort of a mess. Okay. Last thing. Trisection diagrams. This is, I think, maybe something of interest to people. Trisection diagram looks very much the same as a Hilbert diagram. So it's a surface. Instead of two sets of curves, you now have three sets of curves, alpha, beta, and gamma, and they should be, I mean, red, blue, and green, usually. And in some way, that's going to describe how to build a trisection of the manifold. Again, it's very similar to the Hilbert sort of setup, but I won't say too much about it. Basically, you want to start with your central surface in the three manifold, or the recipe says start with the central surface in the four manifold, and you need to know how to go out in each of these three directions. You need to produce, you know, to produce a recipe, and then you'll glue in some four-dimensional handlebody piece.
Yeah. So you just need to know where the cycle is.
Right. And so, as a point this out, the key thing is that, I mean, each of these handlebodies has a prescribed, I erased it, boundary xi is connected sum of S1 cross S2s. Okay. And so, in particular, what's true about these diagrams is that pairwise, like taken two at a time, you just look at the like say the red-blue curves, those should give you genus G Hilbert diagrams for K connect sums of S1 cross S2s. And you can see this, this is the case. So, yeah, I'll just.
So that's a constraint on this.
That's a constraint, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, not any random sets of curves will do. It's not enough to just have anything.
Pairwise
trivial.
So pairwise trivial.
Yeah. But so you may not be able to, three at a time, you can't do anything. And so just to point out, this is on the left, this is CP2. This is the diagram, or a genus 1 diagram for CP2. So as a sanity check, this was supposed to be a genus 1 k equals 0 trisection. So the genus of the central surface is 1. And I need to know what is the genus of the handlebodies. But I see if I look at the red-blue pair, for instance, that's the genus 1 Heegaard splitting for S3.
We don't see the green curve must...
The green curve is not showing up. Yeah, so it runs around and then it does a Gaudian twist. It does a Gaudian twist. Yeah. And again, they may not all be... You may not be able to simultaneously standardize all three sets, but you can always standardize two at a time.
So what kind of link is that? Is this kind of... Does it have a name? Link theory?
Sorry, say that again? Like...
It's category of link, right?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure people may not use that language. They get a lot messier.
If I give you the two surfaces with random curves,
yep.
Alpha and beta, is
yep.
it always a Heegaard diagram for something or not?
So if you just take a surface with two sets of curves on it, it in general is not always a Heegaard diagram for a manifold. I sort of glossed over this. There is a condition on the curves. They need to be what's called a cut system for the surface. So if you cut along all of those curves, you should. You're describing a cobordism to the empty set, so it had better do that. And to do a trisection diagram, it's the same thing. They had better at least all be cut systems. But on top of that, they pairwise have to give you diagrams for that specific three manifold.
So the conditions are complicated.
Yeah. It's hard to see from a given diagram.
Earlier you said it's not a triangle, from the triangle you have splitting. But now that you have this, there must be a structure key to a triangulation that, when you... We have these weird diagrams like that, which are disproportionate locally, they're not in a generic manner. So is it known, essentially what takes place in the Schnorr triangulation, which is such that...
I'm not sure. I think if you pick a trisection, you're going to induce a triangulation. That is true, because you could triangulate the central surface, and then you essentially have prescribed a way to build the rest of the manifold.
Yeah,
or there is a prescription.
Derivatives, like some kind of locus.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Actually, it's a good question. I don't actually know off the top of my head. There may be, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe we could begin. Anyhow, on the right, sorry, I forgot to mention, that's S2 cross S2. They get a little bit more complicated. In fact, they get a lot more complicated. I'm not sure if you can see all of the curves on that. It's a bit of a mess. In practice, you should not actually try to practically compute anything with these, but they are nice diagrams. There is an analogous set of statements. You said this is almost verbatim, the two facts that I gave you about diagrams for Heegaard splittings. Essentially, the exact same statements are true. Two trisections produce isotopic, or trisection diagrams produce isotopic trisections, if and only if they're related by a sequence of those moves. Handle slides, isotopy of the curves, and just diffeomorphisms of the diagram.
Handle slides are the same as slides to reduce.
Familiar with that. And the same corollary is true is that because the analog of the Rademeister-Singer theorem is true. If I just have two random diagrams, I want to know if they produce the same four manifold. Well, I can stabilize them both a bunch and then perform these moves.
Can you draw the stabilization though?
It's a bit of a mess. It really is.
That's
right. Yeah. So in this case, basically you need to tack in loops in each of the handlebodies. So you'll do something like this. You'll increase each of the handlebody pieces by one. Which will increase the genus of the central surface by 3. So on the level of, as far as connected summing, so if you have these diagrams, you're going to connect some standard piece on, and it's something which is quite standard. Looks like this. It's this piece. connect some. The same way that to stabilize a Hager diagram, you connected some with this thing. It's the same idea. It's bigger. And again, it should increase the genus. But to draw it, it really is sort of a. I can't do it by hand, but there are really nice pictures online. Okay. Anyways.
Theorem says isotopic trisections. But
yeah.
What if you just ask if they produce the same manifold in the end?
Oh yeah, and that's weaker in general. So it's yeah. I mean.
Is it?
Yeah. So then you might need to toss in stabilizations.
That's where you have to stabilization.
Yeah. If I just start with.
Stabilization.
Yeah. And you can get all, then it's a just four manifold. Yeah.
So what exactly isotopic?
Sorry.
Isotopic splittings or whatever you call them.
Yeah.
Trisection.
Yeah. It's essentially the same as an isotopic of Hager splitting. So it's a one parameter family of diffeomorphisms which just carries pieces to pieces. So it's the same idea. So maybe I'll wrap up and I'll say a couple sort of what has this been used for recently and maybe what could be done in the future. You can reprove a couple standard sort of four manifold theorems, Rucklin's theorem, Thom conjecture. They both have trisection proofs, which are not really that hard. It's actually pretty accessible. This is work by Peter Lambert Cole, Georgia Tech. I sort of said this earlier today, but there's a sort of a nice theory of knots in three manifolds. They interact very well with Hager splittings. An analogous sort of theory is also true for surfaces embedded in four manifolds. So if a knot will intersect the central surface of a three manifold splitting in a bunch of points, cuts through the splitting a bunch. Surfaces will intersect in a four manifold. Surfaces will intersect the central surface in points, and it will do something in each of the pieces. And there's sort of a nice diagrammatic. Interesting theory for this. This is Jeff Meyer and Alex Zupan. You can also do some amount of four-manifold surgery via these diagrams. This is still like lots and lots of work to be done by this. Sungwon Kim, Maggie Miller, David K, Jeff Meyer, a bunch of people. But I think there's still sort of lots to do. I mean, you can ask. What seems to be the case is that a lot of analogies sort of hold up going from Hager splittings to trisections. And if there are statements that are true in the Hager splitting world, you might ask, they should have some analog, or something should be true in the four-manifold world. What could you do? Again, like I said, if you could prove a Hawkins lemma type theorem, you would simultaneously prove the smooth four-dimensional point conjecture and rule out a bunch of other exotic four-manifolds, which would be, amazing and maybe just not true. I'm not sure.
Is it not proven the smooth four-dimensional?
That's still open. That's right. Anyways, I think that's maybe a good place to end. So thanks very much for your time, guys.
So thank you for your talk, and we have maybe time for one or two more questions.
I do have a question.
Sure. Yeah.
If you think about why you get splitting, very simple from a physics point of view, because it's the simplest way to construct. TQFT, topological field theories, the computing way.
Okay.
Essentially, you think about each end of body as a state, and then you get a number.
Okay.
And then the surgery moves.
Sure.
So, people kind of developed the. So, in this, the usual picture of TQFT that people develop in the IOD, picture is really related to a one dimensional Morse function.
Right.
So it suggests that you should completely revisit the definition of TQFT based on Morse 2. So have mathematicians done that?
Not that I'm aware of. Like I said, I think there's sort of a lot that has yet to be done, or just no one has really thought of yet.
No. Functions are very simple. You think about cobolism, and you move
right.
Something.
Yep.
So that's why. What is the cobolism theory of Morse 2 function?
I think this sort of comes from trying to understand Lefschetz vibrations to disks, so which is sort of like Lefschetz vibrations
okay.
to a disk, which is sort of it's the same sort of idea. It's a map from a four manifold to a disk with
yeah.
prescribed singularity type,
very good.
And maybe there's something there, but that I'm aware of. No one has sort of seriously developed any kind of TQFT stuff from a trisection point of view that I'm aware of. It's entirely possible that I don't want to get caught on camera saying something like that. Yeah, but I think it could be. Yeah.
It seems really orthogonal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did the idea came from?
I think trying to understand left chance vibrations to disk and sort of having normal forms and standard forms for such things. Again, if you have such a sufficiently nice map to a disk, you want to pull back the pieces. That's sort of I think the original point of view. But now it's sort of taken off and it's its own sort of field of study.
I mean, it sounds from what you said like this would be used to generate families of four manifolds. Is that
I think you certainly could. Yep. So I would say it's, if you're familiar with sort of Kirby calculus, it's, or like Kirby diagrams, it has a very similar feel in that it's a very like constructive theory. You can sort of build four manifolds, but it's very difficult to distinguish them because they're diagrams up to moves. So you ruling out whether or not two diagrams are equivalent is quite hard. So it has a sort of Kirby calculus feel to it, but.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Let's close the seminar because Frederick is
Waterloo,
so you have time to.
Yeah, I'm here for.
So that's the thing. It was a nice talk.
Thank you.